the more wisdom there is in some time-tested marketing strategies for grains, which is basically time averaging. Just resist the temptation to heavily bunch your sales in a real speculative manner. Instead, average them across time as intelligently as you can. Basically, it's a classic moment for diversification in your sales. Don't put all your eggs in one basket in terms of selling in a narrow window, because it's so hard to know if that's going to be your best marketing opportunity or not.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Leo Bastos, Assistant Professor of Integrative Precision Agriculture at the University of Georgia. Today, we welcome our guest, Dr. Scott Irwin. He is the Lawrence J. Norton Chair of Agricultural Marketing at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Scott, welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show. It is great to have you here with us today. And as usual, to kick things off, I want to ask you if you can share with us a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are today.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm really excited to participate in this podcast. My background is I grew up on an Iowa grain and livestock farm a long time ago, and got my BS at Iowa State and then my graduate degrees at Purdue, both my MS and PhD in agricultural economics. I've had a lifelong fascination with commodity markets, and in particular, the price of corn and soybeans. And that is pretty much what I started studying in high school, studied it as an undergraduate, studied it as a graduate student, and then continued that in my first academic job, which was at Ohio State in Ag Econ. And then I've been here almost in my second job, 30 years here at the University of Illinois. I'm now in my 41st year as a academic faculty member, and love my job here at the University of Illinois for my interests. Couldn't be a better place in the world for what I like to do. And what I'd like to tell people how to understand my teaching, my research, and my public engagement extension activities, there's a single thread that ties them all together. I'm obsessed with anything that affects the price of corn and soybeans.
Perfect. So that's really exciting and definitely something very complex, right? So I'm very, very excited to learn more on that from you today. So can you tell us a little bit about, so you alluded to some of your research areas, right? But can you tell us a little bit about some of the current projects you're working on the research side?
Most of my career was really focused heavily on research surrounding commodity futures markets, questions about how effectively they performed their price discovery and hedging roles, all sorts of research about USDA forecasts over the years. Probably in the last 15 years, I've more and more heavily specialized my research in biofuels markets and policy. And I probably spend about 80% of my research time today in that area. But again, going back to the thread that I talked about, if you want to try to understand what's driving corn and soybean markets the last 15 years, the first place you need to start is biofuel policy.
That's amazing. Fantastic. I want to follow that up and ask you, can you tell us a little bit about what is the biggest challenge in market grain today that farmers face?
Well, I think the biggest challenge right now is related to policy, trade policy uncertainty that they're dealing with. Very concrete example is right now the Trump administration has supposedly negotiated a purchase agreement from the Chinese government for 12 million metric tons of soybeans this current marketing year, after they had completely shut down their normal purchasing due to the ongoing trade conflict between the U.S. and China. So you're a U.S. farmer right now, a soybean grower, as an example. Should I wait for confirmation of these expected sales that are supposedly agreed to between the administration and China, hoping that that will boost the price? Or should I not trust those agreements? And that's the kind of uncertainty with regard to the timing of grain sales that the farmers are dealing with right now in the grain markets. And it's a very, very tough nut to crack to answer that kind of question, because you're trying to predict political outcomes, not economic outcomes.
Absolutely. Farming has got to be one of the toughest jobs there is, right? Because there's so many uncertainties from so many levels. And definitely the political uncertainty is one that is, that we're really seeing a lot of that currently. So yeah, would you dare recommending something in relation to that to a grower that has the question as far as, you know, should I, and if so, how much should I sell now, or what are your thoughts around that?
The larger the uncertainty, the more wisdom there is in some time-tested marketing strategies for grains, which is basically time averaging. Just resist the temptation to heavily bunch your sales in a real speculative manner. Instead, average them across time as intelligently as you can. Basically, it's a classic moment for diversification in your sales. Don't put all your eggs in one basket in terms of selling in a narrow window, because it's so hard to know if that's going to be your best marketing opportunity or not.
My next question to you here is building on this conversation around what's currently happening today in the U.S. and markets and grain markets, and taking a step back and going back in time. So can you tell us a little bit about how these grain markets have changed and evolved during your career?
The basic functions of the futures markets and the cash markets are the same as they were 150 years ago when they really got their modern start in Chicago. It's to discover the price for a commodity now for various points in the future based on available information, and to provide an effective mechanism for selling off your price risk to somebody else if you want to make that kind of play in the markets. So it's important to understand that the basic functions in a broad sense haven't changed. What are commodity markets at an even higher level have a basic function that can be described this way. The function of the marketing system is to transform raw commodities that farmers produce in time, space, or form into something that consumers want to use in some form. So consumers may not want to use all of the soybeans today, so they need to be stored or transformed in time. Farmers can do that themselves, or they can sell them to somebody else who would do that in the supply chain system. The marketing system needs to move grain from a surplus production area to a deficit consumption area, and that's transforming the commodity in space. It's moving it. And the third is to make the commodity, raw commodity useful, the system can transform it. Soybeans are a great example. We use very, very little amount of soybeans in their raw form. They have to be crushed, is the word to use, into their constituent components, high protein soybean meal and soybean oil to be useful to people. So at a very high level, that's the purpose of the system, is to transform raw commodities in time, space, and form. And then the grain futures markets are a part of that system. And ultimately, we would judge how the grain futures markets perform, how well do they help the entire system perform these larger functions of transformations in time, space, and form. So that's kind of just a very, very quick kind of marketing 101 introduction to what the grain marketing system does. How has that changed? The big changes that I've observed are not so much the functions, but the how those functions get done in our modern grain markets. And the biggest one has been the move from open outcry pit trading for futures markets to totally electronic order matching and just doing away with the very colorful floor that used to exist at the Chicago Futures Exchanges. That's by far and away the big, that's probably the biggest change in these markets in the last 150 years. But there's also been revolutions in communications. You know, the amount of information that is instantly available to all market participants is really rather astonishing, how quickly the markets are now able to react to information as it emerges, you know, moving towards a 24/7 trading world. You know, that I think is where the biggest changes have happened. I mean, literally, you know, 20 years ago, you know, halfway through my professional career, no one really knew what a automated algorithmic trader even was. That had hardly been dreamed up. And now, you know, they're a critical part of how the futures markets operate on a moment-by-moment basis.
This is amazing. And I want to take us on a small tangent here, especially as you bring the point of, you know, how communication changed and just how information is moving so much faster now than it was in the past. My question to you on that is, how have these markets perhaps try to shield themselves from fake information, right? From things that are trying to come in and play a role, although they don't have really a strong basis or are not true at all, right? So how is that being held or worked on through the system?
I think that in the grain markets, I've been incredibly fortunate for many, many, many decades to have excellent benchmark fundamental supply and demand data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. I think that's, in some ways, our best protection from fake information, is that we have excellent standardized data from the government. But I do think that the markets, you know, the USDA information is typically released only once or twice a month. So that's kind of a grounding in the markets information that happens depending on the market once or twice a month. What happens in between those reports, that's where I think AI, fake news, social media, contagions, the classic example of that these days is I think the markets are beginning to develop some calluses towards this, but I think early in the social media revolution, there was always several days in the summer when it seemed like drought concerns about U.S. corn and soybean crops maybe got exaggerated because a few pictures of really drought-stricken fields that are going to be there every year started getting tweeted around. And this caused a little bit of what economists called an information cascade. One person believes it. You know, the more people that believe it, the more people that believe it is that kind of feedback mechanism. And so I think social media has been a bit of a challenge for the market to figure out how to, just exactly what you said, you know, separate out, well, when do those pictures of really bad looking cornfields really signal a problem, and when do they not over social media? So that's a great example. And I think now all of that is going to be really amplified by AI. So it's a challenge, but the one thing that I love about all the traders I have known that have survived and been successful is, wow, they have a filter for nonsense that is very good, or they don't survive. And so fundamentally, that nonsense filter is what's filters out, you know, that nonsense pretty quickly, usually.
Nice. And something I'm very curious to hear what your thoughts on is, the USDA, as you said, is perhaps the main source of credible information when it comes to grain markets and futures. And I've seen anecdotal evidence, which basically means people on social media complaining or mentioning that sometimes, like the world production reports or even the crop condition reports that USDA puts out, may not fully represent what happens in the end. Of course, these are all predictions, so that it makes sense. You wouldn't be 100% accurate. But I guess my question is, how well have these reports been truly close to what in the end of the season is observed after the harvest is finished? Like, can you share some thoughts around that relationship?
Sure. I mean, I've spent my entire professional career investigating that question as one of my main research areas. And, you know, I haven't seen any reduction in USDA's forecast accuracy in the grain markets over time. The demise of the USDA in the face of satellites, big data, machine learning, now AI, has been predicted over and over and over, and everybody gets it wrong, I think, because they simply don't understand some real basics about survey design, which should be very familiar to people in your field. The USDA estimates on yield, acreage, and production are almost guaranteed to be more accurate than anyone else because they take the biggest random survey and they have extremely well-developed statistical procedures that have been developed over, you know, the last 50 years or more. And one of the real secret sauces to the accuracy is their relationship with the farmers that they survey. Like you go to a typical political poll, you know, lucky if you get a 4 or 5% response rate. The USDA takes these giant surveys of tens of thousands of farmers, and they typically get at least 50 to 60% response rates. So why wouldn't they have the most accurate estimates? It's always good for them to revisit their methods and try to adapt as technology changes. And I think they've done a good job of that within their budgetary limitations. But so that's my perspective.
Perfect. I think it's a really important point, and really to clarify that specific relationship there on those estimates. And of course, estimates are always, especially if something so complex at such a large spatial scale, it's going to be inherently difficult to predict regardless who's doing it. But that's very reassuring to know that USDA is doing a great job of that and serving as our trusted source.
Yeah, you know, and it's not to say that there aren't problems that do arise. But I know well the people, they have very good statisticians and they really take their job seriously. But in interpreting, one of the things that you have to learn in terms of complaints about USDA is everyone has a tendency to talk their book, is the phrase they would use in the grain markets, which means, you know, farmers, you know, are naturally long in the markets. And so, you know, any information that drives the price down is going to be very annoying to them. And I'm not saying that that's the only reason farmers complain, but you have to understand that context. Likewise, you'll find, you know, large commercials, you know, the grain industry tends to be the opposite of farmers. They tend to be the shorts or the people selling in the marketplace. And so the piece of information that drives the market price up a lot, and then they have market losses, well, they're going to start, they're the ones that will grumble. So, you know, there's that kind of background economic perspective that you just always have to take into account. And again, I'm not saying that everybody just complains because they're losing money, but it is important context.
Absolutely. Thanks for clarifying that and adding that point as well. All right. So my next question to you is, what do you think is the most important thing that you have learned about grain markets?
Well, I would have to say I've had a lifetime quest to try to understand how to beat the market. And by that, you know, just trading to make money or selling grain at the best opportune times. And the most important thing that I have learned is a deep respect for the markets. And when I think that the markets are getting prices wrong, I have to be really, really careful in reaching that conclusion because there's probably something I don't know or that I haven't understood properly. So that the bottom line is, the most important thing I've learned is it is very hard to beat the markets. Very hard. And anybody who tells you it's easy or they've got the magic formula, my basic advice is run the other direction.
You know, I want to follow that up with perhaps an impression that these days is very common as far as, you know, thinking that if we have enough data, if we have had past data that have where we've seen a diversity of environments and a diversity in the data itself, that we can train an algorithm or maybe an AI to provide a good answer. So based on what you just said, I think you're going to say that's not really the case here, but can you elaborate on that, please?
There's a really counterintuitive theory of how a properly functioning grain market, this applies to the stock market as well. It's something called the theory of efficient markets. That theory says the market is an incredibly voracious and effective information collector and synthesizer. In other words, if you're going to beat that system, you have to have an edge someplace over what all these other incredibly well-capitalized traders and merchants at companies like Cargill and big hedge funds. You have to have better information, better models than they do. And probably the thing that most people would be surprised at is how frequently even really good traders blow up because the markets are so hard. They're so efficient at processing information. And I don't see why AI is going to be any different. Maybe it'll speed up the process of reaching the correct price a little bit faster. But the basic logic of market efficiency holds, which is that the market price is usually right. And that, and the other thing is, there's always kind of an information arms race in these markets. Okay, so somebody figures out an AI large language learning model or machine learning that is a new mousetrap that allows someone to make money for a little while. I can guarantee you it won't be long before that method gets discovered, replicated. And when everybody knows it, no one can make money on it. And that's the treadmill that these markets operate on. Somebody figures something out, well, then everybody else eventually figures it out and price reflects it, and you have to find a new mousetrap.
Perfect. Well, thanks for just going over that. I thought that you're going to say something to that extent, but it was really great to hear your development of that answer as well. All right. So you recently published a book called Back to the Futures: Crashing Dirt Bikes, Chasing Cows, and Unraveling the Mystery of Commodity Futures Markets. I want to ask a little bit about that. Can you share us a little bit about what is this book about, and why this is a great resource for people that are trying to learn more about futures markets?
Well, sure. Well, I've spent my entire professional life around trading, studying, and teaching about grain and commodity futures markets. And, as I've in the latter stages of my career, let's call me a elder citizen in the profession, I wanted to do something different. I wanted to teach people my understanding of how commodity futures markets work. But I didn't want to write a textbook that, I could force my students at the University of Illinois to read it during the school year. But I wanted to attempt to do something that, just someone who had no background in grain markets, commodity markets, livestock markets, whatever, could read it and enjoy learning about commodity futures markets in a really non-technical way. So that was my objective. And so I like to say I wanted to write a textbook that wasn't a textbook. And that's really what Back to the Futures is. It intertwines personal stories of, in particular, lots of rather reckless things I did when I was a kid growing up on the farm in Iowa, many very reckless and dangerous things with automobiles, motorcycles, cows, and in the title. And to make it fun to read. But the wild stories, every chapter starts with some wild story from my life, but they're there for a purpose. I call them market parables. They're there to illustrate, like I use as one of the main characters in the book, my best friend growing up was a guy named Jack Hunter, and he was maybe even just slightly wilder than I was. And he's my stand-in for speculators in commodity futures markets. So kind of the daring do that Jack did represents speculators. And I use my dad as a stand-in for hedgers. And every chapter begins with some kind of hopefully funny, amusing story, and then into the more technical teaching part. And then I intertwine, various questions that I've investigated or been involved in the commodity futures markets. And then I end the book with some discussion about where the markets might be heading in the future. And so it's always important. I knew when I decided I wanted to pursue this project that after nearly 40 years writing as an academic that I would not be able to write something that was funny. Academics don't do humor. And fortunately, one of my dearest friends is a professional writer, Doug Peterson. And so we did it as a collaboration. And so I always want to give him credit for how well it's written and how much fun it is to read.
That's awesome. I'm definitely adding the book to my reading list as well. We're excited to learn what you have to say.
Well, thank you. I'm honored every time someone reads my book.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Especially as you said, if you have, you know, that if you're ready to distill down the technical side of it to be very simple, and you brought in, you know, a funny side to it, it's hard to beat that combination.
Yeah, well, that's the objective, and I'm you know, I think that we succeeded. It's been reasonably popular, and lots of people really have enjoyed reading it.
Fantastic. Well, if you're listening to this episode and you're enjoying this great conversation with Dr. Irwin, make sure to follow us, like this episode on whatever platform you are listening, and also share this with anyone you think can also benefit from this great knowledge around futures markets and grain markets as well.
It's time for our famous three.
Are you ready to maximize your acres? Discover KWS Hybrid Rye, the high-yielding rye with Pollen Plus technology. Designed for superior growth and resilience, KWS Hybrid Rye helps you achieve greater productivity and profitability. Don't miss out on this innovative solution for your fields. Visit KWS.com today to learn more about how KWS Hybrid Rye can transform your farming practices. KWS Hybrid Rye, growing innovation for your future.
All right, Scott, we have our last three questions that we ask every guest that we're gonna get started with those. So the first one here is, do you have any technical resource that you found to be very useful for you and that you think other people can also benefit from?
Obviously, I have to recommend my own book, Back to the Futures. I think is a great starting place for someone interested in this topic. But the book that originally got me interested and is still the classic in this area was authored almost 50 years ago by another University of Illinois professor named Tom Hieronymus, a legend in Illinois. And he wrote a book called Economics of Futures Trading. And you can find links to it on my website, which is scotterwin.com. You can also find links to how you can purchase Back to the Futures, but there's also links under books for Dr. Hieronymus's book. And the numbers are out of date, but the wisdom about grain markets and commodity futures markets in that book is timeless. Give you an idea, I make every one of my grad students read that as their first book when they approach studying in this area.
Fantastic. So just to make sure to repeat this so our audience can go back to it. So first is Back to the Futures, the book by Scott Irwin. The second one is Economics of Future Trading by Tom Hieronymus. Did I get that right?
Correct.
Awesome. Fantastic. Thanks for sharing those. All right. So our second of the three questions is going to be similar. So a resource that you have that you could share with us, however, outside of the technical area that you work and study, right? So something different, something not related to economics.
Yes, I have a great example that probably the most useful book I've read in recent years to try to kind of understand all sorts of economic, technological, and political and social trends is a biography of Elon Musk that was written by Walter Isaacson. It was out maybe a couple of years now. You know, I love reading biographies, and the same author wrote a biography of Steve Jobs, which was wonderful, and I enjoyed it. I got done and I kind of said to myself, oh, I could relate to Steve Jobs. I could ask this guy questions. I could kind of understand where he's coming from. Maybe it's because we're about the same age and had a lot of the same, you know, broad cultural experiences. But I got done with this like 800-page book on Elon Musk. And I thought, I think this guy's an alien. And I'm not saying that as a, you know, because he's obviously, you know, he's a love him or hate him kind of figure now in the United States. But if you want to try to, you know, peel back the layers of technology and people like Elon Musk, it's an incredibly insightful story of how he thinks and where he's pushing his companies and in the directions he's going. Incredibly influential. And it has helped me understand all sorts of things about our economics and politics by having read it in advance of the last election. Nothing that's happened has really surprised me after I read that book.
Fantastic. That's a new one for me as well. But yeah, that definitely one that, you know, especially now that you're saying, because I've read the biography from Steve Jobs and found that fascinating. And, you know, as you're saying, like Steve Jobs was easier to connect with his story, and Elon Musk is such a different one. So it's an interesting one to add.
Steve Jobs certainly had his quirks. He was an unusual person also, but, you know, Elon Musk makes Steve Jobs look normal.
It's definitely a good point for somebody interested in that and follow up with that book as well. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. All right, so our last question here is, in your opinion, what are the skills that successful people around you have? What makes them successful?
Well, I think that there's kind of some broad skills that, you know, for success that you always have to have in any profession. Number one, you have to be passionate about what you're doing. I have never met anybody who's super successful who didn't love what they were doing. And not everybody is fortunate to have that kind of opportunity. But that's it, you know, that they'd have to then combine that obviously with the right skill sets, personality and intelligence. I might be really, you know, passionate about brain surgery, but, you know, I would have never gotten past the first month of medical school and fear of blood, you know, so it's not going to work. So it's got to be something that you're passionate about that you can do. And then you just have to, you have to have an incredibly strong work ethic. And just, you got to keep grinding. And there's just not much that replaces that combination. So those are my general, you got to pair a love of what you're doing with a really strong work ethic.
Fantastic. Thanks for sharing that as well. Well, Scott, that wraps up our episode. I really, really enjoyed having this conversation with you. I learned a lot of new things and some insights that you had about the futures markets and grain markets. I definitely added two books here to my reading list, so I have some homework to do. But thank you so much for being our guest today. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed the conversation as well. There were excellent questions, and I hope you enjoy reading the books.
Thanks so much.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.